This week on Retronauts, we dine on dehydrated Pizza Hut and Pepsi Perfect. Hello, everybody. Welcome again to another episode of Retronauts. I'm your host for this one, Bob Mackey, and today's episode is all about the movie Back to the Future Part 2 and also the three games based on this 1989 movie. Before I begin, who is here with me in the same room?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, and that shark still looks fake.
I agree. And who is the founder of Retronauts that is on the line coming in from North Carolina?
Great, Scott, it's Jeremy Parrish.
And we have flown in electronically the biggest Back to the Future fan I know, who even puts me to shame. Who else is our final guest on the show?
I'm Dave Rudden, and nobody calls me chicken. Nobody.
We will be saying the C word on this podcast, by the way, so parental advisory on this one. But yes, Dave, I do want to say, spoiler, Dave is actually on an episode of What a Cartoon from last month. Before we recorded that, there was not the 35th anniversary edition announced yet, but Dave, you can confirm you now have reserved the 35th anniversary edition of this trilogy, correct?
It was a long and arduous process. I had to figure out which pre-order bonus I wanted the most, and went with the Steelbook, you know, understated.
Does one of them come with a Funko Pop?
One of them comes with a mini hoverboard, okay. Which I'm like, I have many regular size, you know, I have a regular size hoverboard, I think I have like another somewhere else, and I don't need a mini hoverboard, you know, I've got enough Back to Future crap on my desk anyway.
So many.
Are these like Ultra HK, 8K HD super versions or something? Or are they just like
UHD? So that's 4K. Okay. In another 5 years when we're doing the 40th anniversary podcast, then I'll get my 8K sets.
I need to see
I'm sure it'll be virtual reality by then.
Yeah.
I need to see like the 8 or 16,000K version. You have to see where like the latex ends on the masks and the skin begins on the old age makeup. I do need to see that.
Able to read what's on those laser discs in that one scene in the alley.
Oh, yeah. But yes, we're continuing our look at the Back to the Future trilogy with a look at the second movie. Obviously, we're doing one of these for each of the movies. And if you want to check out our look at the first movie, that came out back in June. It's episode 304. That is a Patreon exclusive, so you need to be on the $5 tier to hear that. But this one is going out to the free feed for everybody, and you might be listening to it on it now. And Dave, we all talked about our history with the movies earlier on that first podcast. Where did you enter the world of Back to the Future?
So my story event, like watching Back to the Future, they all kind of really tied together very quickly because I was, I think, 8 or 9 when I'd first seen Back to the Future. And when I really got into the movie was basically like every other summer when I was like from elementary school up until high school, since a majority of my mom's family is in Ireland, we would just take trips to Ireland. And the house that we would stay at was literally a block from a video store. So I must have rented over the course of one summer, which was like we were probably out there for 2 months. I probably rented Back to the Future for at least 25 to 30 of those days. So it was only like a pound back then. So it was not that expensive. I could probably scrounge it from my mom or like find it in couches. And I would just go and rent, like, you know, I was kind of a latchkey kid even in Ireland. I would just walk over there, get it, and then come back. So like it was, yeah. 89 or 90, so I rented that movie, you know, dozens of times. And then by the end of the summer, Back to the Future Part 2 was coming out on VHS in Ireland, so I rented that. But so at around that same time, Back to the Future Part 3 had already come out in America. So I remember talking to my brother, who didn't come with us to Ireland, about the movie and like trying to find out everything about it without having it spoiled. It was very weird time, but like basically I've probably watched part one over 50 times at this point, maybe probably in the triple digits, but the other two I've probably watched dozens of times as well. So but they all really tied in that one summer of 1990 where I kind of got introduced to the first and then the second and third in very fast succession.
So Dave, I do want to ask everybody this, but Dave, were you in theaters for part two? Did you see that one in theaters?
I watched it on VHS in Ireland, and like I remember the clerk telling me like, we're getting it. I'm like, give it to me first because I've literally been here the whole summer. And then when I got to back to America after the summer, you know, This is back when movies would still play for months on end after, so I was able to watch it in theaters in America when I got back from my vacation in Ireland.
Yeah, like I was three when the first movie came out, so if I was taken to it, I don't remember, but I was interested in movies when this came out, and I did see it in theaters, and I'm sure all I took away from this movie was the future stuff, because I had not even seen the first movie. So I'm sure, I know I enjoyed it. I don't even know if I followed the second two acts, but I know I was there. I know I had one of the sets of Pizza Hut future glasses. But yeah, like me and a lot of other kids, we were just signing up for the, this is like the wackier second sequel of the, you know, the 80s had that tradition. And I was just on board immediately from the beginning, just for the future stuff, just barely knowing what this movie was. But Jeremy, you were a bit older when this movie came out, older than us at least. You were an epic teen, an aging teen in the 80s.
I was in junior high when this came out, and I went to see this movie with several friends at the theater, and also my first girlfriend.
Ooh.
It was you know, a junior high kind of relationship, so we were not still together when Back to the Future 3 came out to see it together. But I do remember all of us were like buzzing with excitement when the movie ended, because whoa, there's a third one coming in 6 months? That's crazy.
I'm glad you gave us your account of that, because I remember seeing that and being excited, having never seen a preview, having not even seen Star Wars yet, not knowing movies could do this.
Yeah.
Not having seen Empire Strikes Back. But the story that the history tells about this movie is that because this movie was marketed as part two, not part two of a three-part series, the people who were seeing this movie were down on it because they thought they were being ripped off.
Really?
Well, it's like, yes, on-disc DLC kind of reaction.
Like, yeah, yeah. It's like, I got to pay.
It's the middle section of a trilogy. Clearly, they're going to wrap it up next time, and there's like cowboys and stuff. That's bonkers. They're traveling in time. I love it.
Yeah, having watched it again, probably for like the 20th time, I'm like, how could anyone be disappointed? I just like, oh, what's going to happen? And there's cowboy stuff, and oh man, Doc Brown falls in love. Like, how could you walk out of this movie feeling bad? Henry, you were also 7 years old when this movie came out. Were you in theaters with me?
No.
Not with me, but spiritually.
Actually, no. I'm deconstructing it now, the timeline of events, and I think I must have liked the idea of Back to the Future, but I don't recall seeing the first one first. The second one is what I saw first, but I actually saw it on VHS, but it was, I now recall, and I guess when we do the third one of these, I'll continue this story, but I saw the second one on VHS when it was a relatively new VHS, because at the end of it, there was the thing of like, hey, this is in theaters now. Like, it, I feel like it came out before the second movie was out of theaters, because after seeing this on VHS and being so excited for it and the promise of the next movie, I convinced my mom to take me to the only place showing part three, which was like a dollar theater. So it was like months old at that point, I bet. I think we were the only people in the theater. But it's because of the trailer at the end of this excited me so much. And I think this has so many like hijinks and crazy special effects that it is why when I saw Back to the Future 1 for the first time after as a child, it did feel lacking at first to me, because this has all the bells and whistles and all the cool stuff in it.
I could be missing a few things, but I think the only effects in that first movie are just DeLorean related, like drawing the cartoon lightning around it, making it disappear, things like that. But the rest of the movie is just bookended by these two nice special effects and just like straight character action and drama and comedy.
Yeah. And I will say that, you know, as someone who saw all three movies in their theatrical releases, it felt like it had been forever since Back to the Future 1 had come out. And, you know, it ends with to be continued, but was it really going to be continued? We waited so long, like 5 years, oh my God, for a sequel. And it just felt like, you know, it was never going to happen. So when the sequel finally happened, it was fantastic. But then there was going to be a third one immediately after. It was very satisfying. It was like, whoa, they're going to really wrap this thing up. It's going to end, and you know, we're not going to have to wait 5 more years for another story.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out, Jeremy, because I think a lot of the context of this movie and when it was released was depending on its audience to have seen the first movie a lot. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, it was on video, it was definitely on HBO, and at that point, I'd definitely been on broadcast TV. So you walking into this movie with knowledge of the first movie, it's not 100% necessary, but it makes it a much more satisfying experience because of what happens. And that was much harder to do in the 80s. Now you can just like download it or get the Blu-ray or the DVD, but it was harder to do back then.
And I guess, you know, in 1989, if you were a very informed person in the industry, I'm sure if you read in Variety, you knew it was going to be two parts, or you'd probably see, like, you know, on Ebert, Siskel and Ebert, I bet they would have said, and yes, as we all know, it's two parts and blah, blah, blah. So I'm sure some people knew, but it was very different than now of, like, you can just Google information or, like, you know, the next 8 Marvel films that are planned because they tell you about them, like, 5 years in advance.
But if you're, like, if you're Johnny Lunchpail and you show up to the movies, like, what am I going to, oh, they made another one of those Back to the Futures. I sure like that. You might be less informed.
$4.
Exactly.
No, I mean, I went into it knowing in some capacity that there was going to be a third movie and that they were, you know, filming them simultaneously or something, because I had seen that on maybe Entertainment Tonight, you know, so that was knowledge. But just like having that knowledge abstractly is different than going to a theater and seeing, look, here are finished shots from the next movie. Here is enough for like a 2-minute teaser of the movie that's coming in 6 months. That's a very different proposition. It's not like a potential thing at that point. It's like, this is going to happen and you're going to go see it.
Yeah, this exists. And in fact, the movie was in the can when they had released Back to the Future 2 completely.
I can see why audiences might have felt a little annoyed at the, just because the ending is such a cliffhanger. Like, I know one wasn't made with the intention of that being a sequel, but it's just the fact, like, you're going to save your kids is low-key, like, you know that Marty and Jennifer are okay and his family and his parents are okay. This one, it's like, oh, Doc has literally been like struck by lightning and has disappeared, and now I've got to wait 6 months to figure out how. I mean, obviously that little clip at the end shows you that he gets back in time and meets Doc, but like you really feel for a second, especially before you see that, you know, coming soon Back to Future Part 3 thing, where you literally think Doc might be dead. Or not dead, but you, like, the whole, the cliffhanger is way crazier.
Yeah.
You want to see, you know, fulfilled very, very quickly.
If not dead, then just lost in time and unable to, you know, reunite with Marty.
Well, 1955 Doc is just catatonic. Like,
yeah. He could have hit his head pretty hard at the end of that movie. Let's talk about the production info, which I found like super interesting. Again, I recommend you go out and get the Blu-rays. They come out every 5 years. Please pay $50 every 5 years for the same commentaries, but they're really good. And the way the story goes is, like, you know, the obvious thing is, like, Back to the Future 1 is a huge hit. It was never designed to be a franchise. The ending, We Gotta Do Something About Your Kids, of course, is a big joke. You know, like, we're just going to go off on another adventure. We'll see you later, moviegoers. And then they're going to work on Roger Rabbit or something else. But of course, Universal is like, hey, Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale, we want you to do a sequel. And both of those guys agreed, director Zemeckis and writer Gale, as long as they can get Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd back. And that happened. They got them back. So in negotiating for this movie, the executive that they're working with, Sid Sheinberg, also gets them a third movie. But really, they were like, let's work on the second movie first. It's cool that we can do a third one. That's awesome. We love working with these guys. We love the sci-fi technology and writing this time travel stuff. But let's focus on just writing the second movie for now. So the way this came together, and having heard this and then watch it, I thought it was very clever, is that when they decided to sit down and write the sequel and plan it out, they were like, okay, sequels are very hard to do right. So what is the best sequel? Like, what are the best sequels? From the creator's perspective, they felt the best sequels were ones that directly continued events from the first movie, like in The Godfather. But when they sat down and asked, like, what do audience goers want from sequels? They felt like audience goers want sequels to be like, you know, episodes of TV, like a James Bond movie, where where it's the same characters, but they have new adventures and there's no continuity. So this movie kind of has it both ways, in which you have a new future adventure with Doc and Marty, but you also see all of your favorite characters as they existed in the first movie. In fact, you actually just go back to the first movie. It is like even further exaggeration of like seeing my old friends again. We're like, we're seeing the same scenes again.
In the same third act position as well. Just yes. The third act. It's not all the stuff from before the Under the Sea Dance, Enchantment Under the Sea Dance. It's just the third act of the movie plays out again as the third act.
Exactly. It's all the payoffs of the first movie with none of the setup, because you've seen all of the setup before, and you like different angles of those payoffs too. But yeah, so there are some omissions from this movie, from the sequel. So we talked about it in the first podcast, and that Crispin Glover did not come back. He was hard to work with. He wanted the same deal as Michael J. Fox in terms of the money he was making, and also he didn't like the philosophy of the movies, the very 80s morality of the movies that I think this movie is a lot more self-aware about, given who the villain is and who they're parodying with that villain.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I mean, Crispin Glover's a weird dude, so that I understand that. I do think, though, I mean, he is the co-star of the first movie. Like, he, well, okay, in importance, he's below Doc Brown, but just below Doc Brown. Like, it, but I can see why they didn't want to work with specifically difficult 80s Crispin Glover, who we're used to the more chilled out 2000s onward Crispin Glover. But yeah, so I understand why there was a breakdown there.
And also, Claudia Wells, who was Jennifer in the first movie, really just a prize for Marty to win and to smooch. She's replaced by Elizabeth Shue because Claudia Wells, her mother was suffering from stage 4 lymphoma, and she did not want to leave her to make a movie. And they give Elizabeth Shue a lot more to do in this movie, even though she is like an unconscious body for most of it. They give her like comedic scenes.
Yeah. Her, like, basically, these two movies are her lying down on different things.
Yes. Her being stowed places, presumably safely. Like, just leave her there, Marty. She's fine.
I do think she's a better counterpart for Michael J. Fox. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's just a little bit more wittier. And, you know, and also, I think people were used to seeing Elizabeth Shue in a lot of the things, like Avengers and Babysitting. So it was kind of a neat thing to see. I mean, if you were going to, if you had to replace the actress, like Elizabeth Shue was a great choice.
She brings more star power to it.
Yeah.
I do, you know, one reason I wish Crispin Glover was in this is because I think it would make more poetic sense if Crispin played Marty Jr. That if, you know, especially them meeting in the Cafe 80s would have a lot more, you know, reverberations through history. Yeah. But then I guess it wouldn't have let Robert Zemeckis fall in love with his, you know, Patty Duke technology.
You know? This movie's all duked out. It's true. But yeah, so they're making the sequel. They don't have Crispin Glover, so they replace him with an upside down man who's, well, he's either upside down in archival footage or just like obscured by like, you know, a shot, or he's out of focus. So
Leah Thompson's big hair.
Exactly. So yeah, like this guy, I think his name is Jeffrey Wiseman. Like, I follow the Back to the Future Facebook page just because, like, it will put, like, Back to the Future products in my feed I can look at and not buy. But, like, he and Claudia Wells still both appear at, like, sci-fi and horror conventions. So you can meet upside down Crispin Glover at horror conventions.
I think there was precedent for the way they treated Crispin Glover in this, or treated the George McFly character in this. If you look at one of those sequels they referenced, The Godfather Part II, you never really see Brando. He's always kind of off stage and, you know, like you're aware of his presence, but you don't see Marlon Brando. He's just kind of like this shadowy figure who kind of relies on your knowledge and familiarity with the first movie to know, like, oh, you know, that's Don Corleone in, you know, like his older self.
Yeah.
So they kind of took the same approach with this that they did for The Godfather Part Two, I would say.
Yeah, the last scene in Godfather Part Two is like, oh, the Corleone's the Don's about to enter the room, and then it ends. Mm-hmm, like, Jimmy Caan is there. He's the Leah Thompson of that film because he showed up and dressed all the same.
That is true.
Yeah.
So when making this movie, they were kind of screwed in from the beginning in that their joke ending set up a premise that they couldn't escape from, where the ending of the first movie is, you know, Marty comes back, his family is fixed, he gets all these new prizes like he just won at a game show, but then Doc shows up saying, we gotta do something about your kids, and they fly off where we're going, we don't need roads, the car flies off, and then, you know, the end. But that sets them up for this premise that they were not ready for, because they were like, we have to make this movie about Marty's kids, characters we haven't met. Why would the audience care about them? So this entire first act is just a bunch of jokes to set up a complication that has to be undone. It's kind of weird to think of how essentially in this movie nothing happens, because this entire movie is about Marty correcting something, a mistake he made in the first act. So this movie is just like a very convoluted wheel spinning in place.
And literally, we saw in the first movie that the way you solve something that happens in sort of the future is write a note. Like, literally, that's how Doc was saved at the end of the first movie. If he writes a note for Marty, says, don't open this until, you know, 2015, or maybe a little bit earlier if you want to, like, get a head start on making sure your son doesn't do what the bully says.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Doc should have been like, you got to go to therapy, Marty.
Yeah.
You got to work on yourself.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
I mean, you say nothing happens, but, I mean, that's... Like, the conflict here is all kind of, it's almost internal. It's, you know, like, the character makes mistakes and then has to figure out how to undo those mistakes. And it really kind of gets to the entire premise of time travel, which is, you know, for, like Doc says kind of from the very beginning, like, it's dangerous and you can't take it lightly. Like, it has to be used responsibly. And this really underscores that. Like, what happens when, you know, you don't make an honest mistake, when it's not like a, you know, a genuine error, like, whoa, we didn't expect that to happen. But when you know, try to outthink yourself, you know, you try to get clever and scheme and use time travel for, you know, less pure purposes, and, you know, the fallout from that. So it is kind of a, I guess, an exploration of what happens when, you know, the heroes aren't necessarily perfect, when they make a mistake. You know, you have to get over that. And I think that's a story that you don't really see explored in Hollywood blockbusters that often. So it makes it kind of interesting. And I guess you know, I can see the criticism that it's wheel spinning, but it's really more of a morality play and kind of an exploration of, like, what happens when the hero is fallible.
Yeah, it's an exploration of that, and just, like, having as much fun with time travel mechanics as possible. Mm-hmm. It's really an exploration of that. But yeah, I do think it does undercut in a fun way the ending of the first movie, where it's just like, here are all your prizes. And then, even though Doc Brown's morality involving time travel is very arbitrary and suspect at times, I think it boils down to, like, these small scale changes to your own life are okay, but you can't become, like, a billionaire tyrant. That is unethical. But if you want to fix your family a little, that's cool, we can do that. But you can't become, you know, king overlord of this enclosed Hill Valley snow globe world where nothing else exists outside of it.
Yeah. I think they had just been thinking about all of the things they could do with time travel that the budget wouldn't allow for in the first one. So they just, like, can go money crazy with this one. I mean, though the budget, I doubt, is comparable to, like, a Marvel movie budget now, but still pretty big budget movie for the time.
Even in the first movie, Marty wasn't out to make his family better. He stumbled into something, you know, completely sort of outside of his own power, and just wanted to put things right. And the fact that his family ended up better, and, you know, his father had more of a spine versus Biff Tannen and so forth, like, that was incidental. That wasn't his intent. He didn't go there thinking, like, I'm gonna stick it to Biff. That just kind of unfolded naturally as a result of him just trying to put things right. So, you know, I think when you look at time travel that way, like, you know, if you're trying to change time and history for your own benefit, like, that introduces danger. And, you know, if that happens naturally as the result of just, you know, trying to do the right thing, well, that's something else.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there's also the whole impetus for this, you know, the second and third act, literally a conversation between Doc and Marty where he says, look, you're going to be in the future. You're going to see things that you might be able to take back in time with you, or just think about and use to your advantage. Don't do it, because it'll screw things up. But, you know, that conversation would be weird in a movie like this. But if Back to the Future was real, Doc would probably warn him at some point not to do this.
Yeah, I mean, we know, like, in terms of morality, it's okay to use time travel to prevent your own death or to extend your life. That's perfectly fine. But gambling, Don't you dare. I do want to talk about some of the other movies that they, the other ideas they're kicking around for this movie. So, like, when deciding upon the first movie, what they wanted to do, they had the idea of, like, well, what if Marty does something in the 1950s that changes the 1980s? But they're like, well, we don't have the money for that, and we found the character-based approach was a lot more interesting. So that's why they kind of really stuck with that idea in this movie, just seeing the effects of time travel and the morality of time travel, more of that explored. One of the ideas they thought of was that instead of giving himself the almanac in 1955, Biff gives himself the almanac in 1967. And in trying to get that back, Marty endangers his own conception. When, because Marty was born in 1968.
Okay.
Yeah, so
that's not a bad idea. And you get 60s signifiers instead of, you know, the 50s ones.
Right. And but they thought ultimately that's what the first movie was about anyways, like Marty getting these people together. So they're like, well, that's too close. So their original script for this movie, it sounded crazy at the time, but now it's like, well, that's a Marvel movie. So their entire script for this movie originally was a 3-hour epic that also contained the events of what would be the third film. So the third film in this movie was the last hour. It was like a weird fourth act that felt kind of unnatural. So they deliver this to their producer, and the producer's response is like, we are not going to make the most expensive movie ever for the sequel. We're not going to do that. And so what happened was, the writer Bob Gale took this script, expanded it as much as possible, and in the process of doing that realized that they had a potential two sequels on their hands for this one script, making it into two different movies. So what they did was they pitched a crazy idea at the time where they're like, this one script is two movies, and it'll be a two-part movie in which we release the first part in Christmas of 89 and the second part of summer of 90. They wanted a summer of 89 movie, but Zemeckis was too busy at the time. Mm. And actually, the filming of this movie would not have made that possible. So to make it up to them and to make this entire huge script a reality, they're like, we're going to do a two-parter with a Christmas of 89 release and a summer of 90 release. And although the studio was like, that is a crazy idea, they were able to get their way when they convinced Universal, look, we can make one $65 million movie or two $35 million movies. We're going to make a lot more money with the latter option.
And it's, I mean, it's also such a smart move you think about now, because, like, you know, Michael J. Fox is looking less like a teenager every day in 1989. So, I mean, what if they wait till 1992 or 3 to film another movie with him? Is he still has to play a 17-year-old?
Yeah, like, I think Michael J. Fox is now he's like the world's oldest teenager in this movie. He's like almost 30.
Yes.
He's getting a little puffier because he's not doesn't have the teenage metabolism anymore.
A teenager from a 70s movie, basically.
It's true, yeah. But
well,
yeah.
He was 35. I think this movie would have been a disaster. Not a disaster, but I don't think it would have fared as well if it had come out in the summer of 89, because there were, you know, there was that whole Batman thing to go up against. That really kind of sucked all the oxygen out of the room for theatrical releases that summer. So
didn't it kill
I think
UHF?
You know, pushing it back to the holiday season was a good idea.
It definitely killed UHF, although yeah. I think Last Crusade was also summer of 89, and it escaped
unscathed. That's true, but I think that came out before Batman, didn't it?
But Spielberg, I guess, keeps his him from hurting his friend there. Those types of productions were not unheard of before this. The two I could think of were the producers not of the Superman movies, Christopher Reeve Superman movies. They did a Three Musketeers where they filmed both movies back to back to save money.
Yeah.
And they wanted to do the same with Superman 1 and 2. And they filmed like Superman 1.5 and then fired Donner. And they basically had to just film it all over again for the real sequel. But there had been plans for that, those kind of ultimately a money saving production if you plan to do a sequel in the first place. But now this is entirely normal. Like the Matrix did it, the Lord of the Rings films, Hobbit, and like most Marvel films, the Infinity War stuff was filmed back to back with Endgame, which also just Endgame is Back to the Future 2 as well.
Actually, yeah. Maybe. That's that Three Musketeers thing you're talking about, Henry. That is what inspired Zemeckis and Gale to have a preview for the next movie, because that Three Musketeers movie had a preview for the Four Musketeers at the end.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but go ahead, Dave.
I was just wondering if there's ever been an instance where they did these back-to-back, you know, filming situations where it's ever been the first of the two movies ended up being a flop. I mean, it's usually these are like the second and third movies, like with The Matrix or an established franchise like Marvel movies. But it, like, if Back to the Future 2 had just tanked for some reason, I wonder how that would have affected 3. You know, it's in the can, but like,
yeah,
you know, did they not get much promotion? Do they cut back on certain things? They cut parts out of the movie?
I think they would just cut their at this point, they just cut their losses and release it. I don't know. In this point in history, they might just put it on like Disney Plus or something.
Yeah.
But there was no other option back then. Even direct to video was sort of a rarity in 90.
I guess in 1990, you pull back all your ads for it.
Yeah.
Just made it lessen the impact as much as possible.
But yeah, we mentioned things like Star Wars and The Matrix as other movies that have a similar, you know, trilogy heat to them. And like those movies, this one is the one who had to create sequels not knowing with the first movie there would be more of a story. So like Matrix, Back to the Future, and Star Wars were like, yeah, that's one story. Mm. Presumably these people could do other things, but now we need to extrapolate. And I honestly feel like this is the best version of that. Like, they were the most successful with this trilogy. I don't know if anyone agrees with me.
It's definitely successful. I don't know if it's the most successful, but I think, you know, the kind of writing hook, the prompt that the end of the first movie provides, even though that does limit them in a sense, it also gives them a direction. It says basically like, hey, you're going to see the future. So everything kind of, you know, emerges from that that little hook that you have at the end. Whereas at the end of Star Wars, it's like, hey, everyone gets medals except Chewie, and we won, hooray, and Darth Vader's still alive, but now what?
The sequel's going to be the search for Chewie's medal.
Yeah. Right,
yeah. With Star Wars...
My favorite Star Trek movie.
with Star Wars and Matrix, they end with a happy enough ending, but both make it clear of, like, the ultimate evil has not been defeated, and you have hope that they can now do it, but you can still look forward to that. But Back to the Future, there was no giant villain. Like, the closest thing to a villain in the first one is Biff, and he's just, like, an asshole, you know? Yeah.
He's so neutered at the end of the first one. He's basically a friend that it is kind of shocking to see him become this ultimate evil in the Hill Valley universe.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that you mentioned it before, but just the movie being called Back to the Future, even if they didn't have that little coda at the end of the first movie, I think a lot of people would have been upset if they never actually went to the future.
Yeah, that's true.
It's not an afterthought in the movie, but it is not as much as you would have expected it to be. But I think even as a kid, like, wanting the future so badly, just the amount that they give you here feels like enough.
Yeah, I guess as a kid, like, I honestly took the title of the first movie literally, which is why I thought it wasn't very good. I was like, wait, they don't go to the future. They go to 1985. But yeah, that is the future if you're in 1955. But I like how at the end of this movie, Marty says, I'm back from the future. That would have been an awesome title for this. Like, Back to the Future 2, Back from the Future.
Well, you know, in the Marvel, the Disney way of naming movies now, you wouldn't have a number on it. You would call it Back from the Future or Back to the Future Continues or Marty's Revenge or Biff's Revenge. That's what you call it. Like, numbers in sequels.
Biff Rising.
Yes, yeah. Numbers in sequels don't happen anymore.
And this is a classy sequel. It's got part two in Roman numerals, not just the big tacky two at the end of this title.
I also, when I looked at the filmography of Zemeckis with this, I kind of see this as this inflection point where Zemeckis heads towards making the types of movies I like less than Back to the Future, because he always loved special effects and doing it. This wasn't like his first special effects movie, but the amount of tinkering you can do with like a small number of actors, this really opens the door for like all the stuff he does in Forrest Gump and Death Becomes Her, which tools around with like, oh, we've got one actor, but we can keep changing them and put him in different places, all these special effects. And that snowball keeps rolling down the hill until eventually he's like, just everyone's green screen. And Tom Hanks is 17 people in Polar Express, and Beowulf is this, like, and that Marwin movie, all these things. Like, he got too into how special effects could make an actor be 17 characters.
I totally agree with you, and I don't want to be a crank that's like, well, all CGI is bad, and you know, people have to work very hard to make CGI good. It's not just like the computer figures it out. But I feel like when I'm watching the special effects in this movie, as shaky as they can be when you're looking very closely at the screen, these are all like optical effects. Some are computer assisted, but they're all like done in camera or like on film. There is like a physical element to all of them, which makes the hard work that went into them even more interesting and can be appreciated more. I know, you know, computer stuff is very hard to do too, but something about the physical element of all of these effects makes them more impressive. Just the hard, how hard they had to work.
Yeah, well, comparatively in Endgame, when all of the scenes of them meeting themselves in the first Avengers movie happen, like, it, I guess it does feel less good, cool to me, because I'm like, well, I know, even before I watch the behind-the-scenes features of, like, how did Captain America meet Captain America? It's like, well, they just moved the head of Chris Evans onto a stunt guy. Like, that's
yeah.
What they did.
When I find stuff out like that, I mean, I know like there's special effects, but I feel betrayed almost. Where it's just like, wait, they weren't even in the same scene together? Like, no.
Yeah. Oh,
this actor's too busy for that.
Yeah. It's like, well, Tom Holland was filming another movie, so we just had you know, Star-Lord hold a guy, and then they just put in Tom Holland's head later.
So let's talk about the actual movie. So this opened on November 22nd, 1989. It made $336 million on a $40 million budget. So coming in slightly over budget, but still very impressive. I want to go over like the you know, the mechanics of the movie, but I do have some like upfront stuff I want to talk about. And I do think that the first movie and the third movie have a lot of heart. But I feel like this movie has zero heart in a very charming way, in that I talked about it before, in that this movie is really about like the mechanics of time travel and having fun with that and undoing an act in the first act. And I feel like the characters don't grow because this is just like the rising action of the three-part trilogy. Like, all the resolution and Marty's resolution and Doc's resolution all happens in the third movie. So this movie does feel empty, but I think they lean into it when it's like, no, this movie's all about the mechanics and cause and effect, and we're going to be moving so fast you won't notice that the characters are kind of not really changing yet. That's all for the third movie.
And when the third movie is going to take away time travel, like, time travel happens... Well, I guess if you count the train flying away at the end, then it happens like four times in that movie. But really, plot-wise, it only happens twice for Marty to go to the Old West and then to come back from the Old
West. It's just like the first movie, yeah.
Yeah, so since they're going to have almost no time travel there, then they need to time travel to four separate locations in this movie to make it as crazy as possible to really play with it. And
this is the only time that time travel is, there's no barrier to it. Mm-hmm. In the first and third movie... Something has inhibited the DeLorean that keeps it from being able to serve its purpose. This, they can, you know, they decide to go somewhere and they go somewhere multiple times.
Yeah, it does. It makes it a way harder story to tell, I think, too, if you can just like, well, then the guys get in their time machine and go somewhere. There's the problem is solved.
Thankfully, Mr. Fusion has taken care of all of that.
Yeah.
A big part of the conflict comes from the fact that, you know, the time travel is so open-ended that people are using it, or someone is using it, without their awareness and changing history behind their backs.
Yeah.
So that's a very clever way to kind of, you know, make the most of that.
Yeah. Though the kind of thing that you have to keep out of your head is the fact that since they can time travel at will, they almost have unlimited chances to solve this. Like, if you know, the whole thing happens at the Enchantment Under the Sea dance and he's not able to get the magazine back, or the almanac back, he can just time travel again and try to find another route to get it.
By the end,
complicate the movie way too much.
By the end of this plan, there are like 13 Martys in 1955.
Yeah, pretty much.
All helping each other. Yeah.
Or Marty just shrugs like, well, I guess I'll try again on November 13th and get it from Biff, you know?
I'm glad they overlooked
Biff
that.
Biff has to sleep at some point, so how about we time travel when Biff falls asleep and then we'll just get it?
I think you have to overlook that fact. Like, oh, we could just do this as many times as we want, then there's really no stakes. So like in the first movie, Marty is the audience vessel character, so he doesn't really need a personality. He's like the cool suburban teen we all want to be, and everything needs to be explained to him. So that is his role in the first movie, just to be shouted at and explain things explained to him. But in this movie, he knows how time travel works, so he needs to be more than just that character. So they do add an element to him that will pay off in the third movie, where he has some serious pride issues. And at first I thought, well, yeah, this comes out of nowhere, doesn't it? And even the writer admits, like, yeah, we needed to give him something to do, so that's what we gave him. But now, watching it again, my own, like, headcanon is, like, doing this time travel thing in the first movie gave him this, like, overwhelming sense of pride about his abilities and, like, playing God, and he needs to be humbled. Mm. And that is what gave him the chicken complex, as I call it, in this movie.
Chicken complex. That fits.
Yeah, to this movie's credit, as many times as I had watched the first movie, the first time, probably the first few times I watched this movie and the third movie, I never realized that the chicken thing was confined to these two movies. It was only after, you know, a couple years worth of watching this movie and having it, probably once I got it on like DVD, did I realize, oh yeah, that whole chicken thing was not in the first. I mean, he's still hot-headed in the first and getting into fights with Biff when he shouldn't, but the whole, like, cementing it with the fact that he's being called chicken, it seems subtle enough that I didn't notice it that much back in the day.
Yeah, me neither.
I'll say that I definitely, it stood out to me after I went back and watched the first movie again. Like, that was one of my first times I can remember, like, looking at something and saying, oh, you know, this is kind of a story contrivance that they came up with. And, you know, invented just for the sake of conflict here. It didn't really exist before. But, you know, it doesn't take me out of the movie. It's a little conspicuous, I think, especially in the third movie, I would say. But we're not really talking about that here.
Yeah, like, I do like how they decided upon the word chicken because it's so hilariously innocent. This is the year 1989. They could have pulled a Bill and Ted and they could have called Marty something much worse.
Yeah.
They could have gotten away with in a family movie.
Yeah, or even just, you know, a pussy or whatever.
Yeah,
they could have gotten that. But, like, chicken, I guess, you know what, really,
that's more of a family friendly movie than that.
what works with chicken too is it is kind of timeless. If you hear a guy in 1955 or a guy in 1885 call somebody a chicken, it maybe that isn't truly period correct, but it does not sound anachronistic to your
and
ears.
It's still happening in 2015. One of my favorite scenes is old Lorraine explaining how the view screen repairman came, and he ended up calling Marty McFly a chicken, and then he left. It's like, what is the context of your repairman calling you a coward?
You couldn't pay for the insurance on this, huh? Man. What, were you a chicken?
Man.
Yeah, I like that chicken is so ubiquitous in the year 2015 that someone has a soundboard that they carry around with them to play sound effects of a chicken whenever they insult someone.
He's a real like shock jock, that that Biff assistant.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was real 2015,
morning crew,
you'd have to see that guy pull out his cell phone to quickly download chicken sound app and then play it off of his phone.
But that comes out of nowhere. But I do like, they have to give Marty something. He's such an empty character in the first movie, but it's fine because he doesn't need to have a character. The movie's about the mechanics, and the movie, the character stuff is all about George and Lorraine. Marty is just like plot mechanics pushing them together for the most part.
Well, he's supposed to be everyday kid of 1985. There's not... if you add too much to him, then he's not just like this cipher of like, well, no, he's your typical 85 kid. He likes hard rock and roll, and he wants to make out with his girlfriend. You know, that's just, and all he wants is a Pepsi Free. That's it.
And I will say, watching this again, the movie has so much respect for its world and characters that I love how the scenes that they sprinkle around scenes that have already existed, they all work. They could all conceivably be part of the huge continuity when they could have easily cheated. Mm. People would have been mad, but they could have been like, you know what? Screw you. At the end of the movie, Doc Brown says we're going to outer space or something. We're going to change things up. But no, like from the very beginning, they let you know what they're doing because the car takes off. what we saw at the end of the first movie, and then we see old middle-aged Biff go, what the hell? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's when we get our title screen. And that could have been in the first movie. There's no there's no reason that couldn't have been in the first movie. So, like, everything they do in this movie has such respect for the characters and the world that they built. They don't do anything that's a huge cheat. And then when they go back to the first movie again, the scenes they add could all fit into the timeline of those events.
Yeah, I it shows also, too, what a gigantic risk Doc Brown was taking in that moment of landing and flying away. Like, it's why they have to write Doc pretty crazy in some parts of this, because they're like, but then why'd you do that? He's like,
yeah,
you know, I had to.
He has so many crazy explanations that just go by so quickly, and because it's Chris Lloyd doing it, you totally buy it.
Yeah. Well, this... rewatching this one, this was when it really hit me, like, okay, this is Rick Sanchez. Part two is Doc Brown is the most Rick Sanchez-y of all his characters. The way, like, especially he'd be drinking in the scene, but Rick Sanchez would have done the exact same thing of hearing Jennifer go like, oh my God, can I see my wedding? And he'd be like, shut up. And he just makes her fall asleep.
Knocks her out. Yeah.
It's like, she's asking too many questions, Marty. You know what it is? And Marty's like, well, you're the doc. Like, that has to explain so much of this movie where Marty just goes like, well, you're the doc.
Oh, geez,
so
doc.
I trust you, doc.
You invited my girlfriend just to knock her out? But so I will say, like, so Crispin Glover is gone. So, like, basically what they do to replace that weird energy is Tom Wilson becomes the MVP playing four different Biffs in this movie and also a Griff. So he's playing 1955 Biff, who we saw before. He's playing 1985 Biff very briefly in the beginning. He's playing 1985 A Biff, who is Donald Trump. We'll get more into that later. And also 2015 Biff, who is the crotchety, but rather, like, he's gotten over his rage. I love how, like, old Biff has finally got it figured out.
Yeah.
And then Griff, who has got to be, like, some kind of weird, like, future drug addict.
This film is cyberpunk. Like, he has cybernetic adjustments to him that have driven him crazy. No, Tom Wilson's the greatest, yeah.
I do wonder if Michael J. Fox had seen, even just in Back to the Future Part 1, where Tom Wilson gets to play 85 and 55 Biff, and... you know, thought, like, I want to get in on this action, because Michael J. Fox does a lot of the same sort of thing, playing multiple characters. And I think part of that, as you mentioned before, is because Crispin Glover didn't want to do this movie. But over the course of these two movies, he kind of does that same sort of Tom Wilson. I would argue not to quite as good an extent. Mm-hmm. But he does get to play multiple versions of himself.
Yeah, Michael J. Fox, they don't give him a lot to do with these different variants of Marty, but I walked away from this movie with a greater appreciation for, like, pathetic, sweaty, middle-aged Marty. He feels now like a Tim Heidecker character almost.
He does, yeah.
like this awful, like, Willie Loman type, this just horrible loser, just sweaty loser.
But I think Tom Wilson's, like, he's the best part of this movie, I think, and he's the... I think this is what truly made him hyper typecast as Biff. Like, he's so good as Biff in the first one, but here when he shows you four flavors of Biff, and if you count the grandma, five flavors of Biff, because he's her too, that it makes you only associate him with a Tannen. You don't think of Tom Wilson as anything else. And if you see him in anything after this, you're just like, oh, hey, it's Biff. Good old Biff.
And for a while, he hated that, but he eventually got over it, thank God.
He sang that song enough times that he freed himself of it.
This is Super Nintendad.
You know I don't like Dr. Mario. I think he's a fraud back alley doctor.
Am I very happy to be here?
With the help of a doula, you can do anything in the tub.
You're looking at the Nintendo knitting machine!
Do you feel that I abused you by making you play Night Trap?
I challenge you guys to a dance-off at McDonald's tomorrow's.
What have I done, Sweet Jesus? What have I done?
Super Nintendad's Entertainment Podcast, every week right here on Greenlit.
Do you love The Legend of Zelda? Here at Chat of the Wild, a game club podcast, we have been using our Lens of Truth to do deep dives on your favorite action-adventure series to find out what makes this franchise so amazing. Join us right now as we sail through the Wind Waker or check out any of our past seasons. New episodes drop every Wednesday here on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
Matt, I've got a great idea for a podcast. You and me, we watch movies, right? And some of them are kind of bad, and so we make fun of them. But maybe some of them are good.
Chris, that's a great idea. Let's do it. And eat snacks. Movie Fighters, an original idea on the Greenlit Podcast Network.
Video Death Loop is a podcast where we watch a short video clip on loop until we just can't take it anymore. Along the way, we'll try our best to make each other laugh and to hold out longer than the other guy. You can jump in on any episode, no need to worry about continuity. Check out Video Death Loop on the Greenlit Podcast Network with new episodes every Friday.
Let's talk about the events of the movie and like the setting and stuff. So, you know, so the movie's a little messy, but they do manage to clean everything up by the end. But I do like how every act is a different time period. So there's 2015, 1985, and 1955. It's a very clean cut between these three acts. But of course, like, the main attraction, it comes first, and that is 2015. And Robert Zemeckis was like, I never wanted to make a movie about the future because you're always wrong, and we knew we'd be wrong, so quit pointing it out how all the ways we're wrong. But the way he got over that was like, let's make the future fun, not like a Blade Runner thing. Let's make it fun. And also, because we don't know what'll happen, this will be the most like gag-intensive part of the movie. And what I really love about this part is, especially on like a 4K Blu-ray or even on DVD, if you look at the production design, it is amazing. You will catch new signs, new gags, new people in the background every time that are telling all of these stories that are unaddressed by the characters, but they really paint a depiction of a world that they don't explore further outside of this first act.
It is amazing. Honestly, like, this is the first time I've watched part two in full probably in like 10 years. And
Henry, we were in the same theater in 2016.
but I pressed pause over and over again just to be like, my God, the set, it's Zemeckis and Gale, their vision is great, but also like they must have employed some of the best like prop designers and set designers in the world at the time, because it is so rich in physical stuff. Like, that's also, again, I don't want to, I feel like I'm now just complaining about Marvel movies. But when everything is a green screen that you're walking around, you can tinker with that stuff right up to the last minute.
Yeah.
But when they decide what a Texaco is going to look like in 2015, they got to build it. And it's there. And they're like, well, wouldn't there be posters in this alley? What's on the posters? Oh, people have hoverboards. Why aren't people walking around with other boards? Like, all these things that inform the world that if you pause it and you think like, oh, what led to this moment? Just a million little things that I just love every moment of. And just like, Jaws 19 is directed by Max Spielberg, yeah, the real son of Steven Spielberg, stuff like that. God,
I think it helps a lot that this movie is not color graded the way movies are now, so everything is kind of natural looking, in addition to, you know, just having actual physical sets and props. You know, it is like, this is the actual colors of the world, the sky, the grass, the water, et cetera. People, you know, it's not orange and blue or, you know, desaturated or whatever. And, you know, they kind of lean into that really by making kind of the overall aesthetic of the future, like the future of the late 80s, where it's all like neons and rainbow colors and like, you know, hyper colors and color changing. Like, it's just a rainbow of just eye-popping color, but at the same time, you know, aside from the hoverboards and the emphasis on neon, they don't really go like super crazy. You know, flying cars, okay, they don't go super crazy with the technology of the future. I don't know, maybe they do actually. Yeah, as I'm thinking about it, it's kind of dumb. But like the overall world, aside from like the technological stuff, it still is, you know, Hill Valley. It's still the city. Yeah. It's recognizable. I guess that's what I'm talking about here, is that, you know, they don't like make it some, you know, megalithic skyscraper filled hellhole or something. It's still just like the city, but neon and with flying cars.
Yes. I mean, the kind of an unsung star of the first movie was that one lot in Universal, which they were able to completely renovate to change to 1955. The fact that it was still, you know, in the same sort of condition, you know, 3-4 years later when they're recording this movie and able to redo it for 2015. I mean, that goes a long way. Like, you're so used to, especially if you've been watching part one over and over in the 4 years between these movies, that same lot, you know, just done up to future. And also because it's a lot, you know, you don't have to worry about something erroneous being in the background. It's like a close set that they can make to 2015. I mean, I don't think that's the same lot, obviously, in 1885, but to look ahead a little bit. But just the fact that, yeah, that this one place, you've seen it before so many times if you watch that first movie, that you realize, like, oh, this is kind of that same framework, but everything's futuristic, and there's nothing that they can, you know, that you have to have a pretty crappy set that something got through. And I've watched this enough times that there aren't that many, you know, no one's wearing the wrong watch at any time, or there's never the wrong car in the background, which you would see in other old movies, or other movies that were set in the past. But this, that's, you know, it's because it's that close set, they were able to, you know, cater everything about the background to work perfectly.
The continuity is great, and they actually had to film all the 55 stuff first so they could just tear it all down and then build the future city on that set. And yeah, like the way they, like, the continuity is great. Even in 55 stuff, they're like, okay, for our 55 world, we can't have every car be a 1955 model. It's got to be that year and earlier, because presumably people have older cars too. So they were like paying such close attention to detail to like every element of this world.
And the future world too, there's so many just like great throwaway lines by the doc. I just had this, I laugh so hard when he talks about, like, sorry for the disguise, I replaced all my blood and blah blah blah. And,
yeah,
and
I
here,
didn't
look
think
at this.
I didn't think you'd recognize me.
Yeah, and then when he takes it off, he looks exactly the same, and Marty just goes like, yeah. Good.
It's all because, like, I totally forgot Christopher Lloyd is in his like 40s in these movies, and I was like, oh right, he wasn't an old man in the first movie. He just didn't want to wear like slightly wrinklier makeup for this entire movie.
It's basically, you get to watch Christopher Lloyd remove his makeup that he wore in the first movie in the past, in 2015. God, and another thing I love about the 2015 they imagine is logos are on every single thing. Like, it's everything is the AT&T thing. Everything is like Pizza Hut. Logos are on everything.
And that's that predicted a lot about the future. Yeah. We'll put a logo on a banana if it'll help things sell. But yeah, a big quote unquote joke in this episode is the very idea that 80s nostalgia would exist. Like, that was very cheeky at the time, and now we are on a like basically 80s nostalgia podcast for the past 16 years. So yes.
I mean, I don't think it was a joke that 80s nostalgia would exist, because, you know, the whole first movie was predicated on 50s nostalgia. I think it was specifically the things that we would be nostalgic for were meant to be the jokes. Like who now cares about Ronald Reagan versus the Ayatollah Khomeini? Like, who cares about New Coke? I mean, those are kind of footnotes in history. Those aren't the things that we're nostalgic for. In fact, I would say 80s nostalgia now is for things that didn't actually exist, like, you know, the super neon colors, you know, vaporwave type stuff. Like, that wasn't really a thing outside of, you know, Miami Vice cover album covers or something. Yeah. So I think the joke there was like, here's the weird things that people are going to care about in the future, which of course, no, actually we don't care.
This being filmed in 1989, like, they were able to say, okay, these are early to mid 80s things that we know people will recognize as being a little bit older, like Beat It. Or, you know, even at that point, Ronald Reagan wasn't president anymore. And like early NES games, that, I mean, maybe to me that was like, you know, and this being a video game podcast, I'm like, oh, well, I could recognize that as a, you know, a first generation. I know, Jeremy, you know exactly the order that Wild Gunman is, but I recognized even then in you know, 89, 90. I'm like, oh, that's a really early NES game. That's in the arcade for some reason.
Yes. Yeah. We talked about that on the Western podcast, didn't we?
On our Cowboy Games podcast.
There's a whole story there.
Yeah. But they CGI'd that NES game up to make it look even goofier and prettier.
But yeah, 1989, they're buying products from 84 to put in like a window dressing, including a Roger Rabbit. That was pretty great to see.
And the Jaws NES game, it's only going up in value.
It's worth like $12 now.
That, the 2015 is just a bunch of jokes, but I am sad we are now beyond that time.
Yeah,
for sure.
it was a dark day when you can no longer post the meme. Today was the day Marty McFly went to the future. but yeah, like all of the crazy stuff in the background, just like pause every frame. Like I catch something new for the first time every time I watch this movie. One of the ones was like when Marty Jr. Is like first revealed through like the binoculars. He's distracted by two women with enormous breasts, and I was just like, what is why? But then I paused the screen, and they're coming out of a breast augmentation clinic.
I missed
And then like breast implants are like a big thing, like an undercurrent in the future. You see like an ad for it on like the giant TV that Marty Jr. has.
Guess you know, breast augmentation had become pretty popular by the late 80s in general, so I guess they were extrapolating that 30 years in the future it's like a an hour-long procedure and you just walk out with wonderful breasts.
It's like getting a filling or something. But yeah, another thing I think they successfully predicted was, if you look at Marty Jr., I think that's his name. Is his name Marty Jr.?
Yeah, Marty Jr.
If you look at what a just technology and obsessed distraction he is in the world, like he is like, seems like a parody of like the late millennial, early zoomer, where it's just like he's watching 8 screens at once, and then when he has to come to dinner, he puts on his glasses. If they knew about iPhones, he'd be looking at an iPad while at dinner. But like the idea of children just being so inundated with screens, I think they definitely saw that coming for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also a drone walking a dog, you know, I think that just happens now.
And every taxi driver has a parrot. I'm into that.
One more subtle joke I really love in there is when we all remember the guy telling him, like, put some money on the cubbies. But the first thing he does is ask for a couple $100 to fix the thing. That's a joke about inflation, that he's asking for. He's just on the street going, like, could you just give me $200? Like, come on, just $200. That's so good. I love that joke.
And of course,
they didn't predict GoFundMe. And just to go back to that self-walking dog, I guess they didn't predict the gig economy, but I think one of the kind of unsung elements, and also I have the Back to the Future Part 2 novelization.
Mm.
I think that part of the undercurrent when in that the Cafe 80s is the people who are riding the bicycles, I think they're powering the place in some way, and that's how they're paying for their food.
Interesting.
I have to go back and revisit
Griff
that.
Griff does tell them to get back on their bikes,
Yeah, I could see that being just something that's happening in the background where it just seems like set dressing, but there's actually like a lore reason for it to happen.
Yeah, though the one thing that really sticks in my head about the novelization is they actually go into a page or two about the police women who pick up Jennifer and bring her back to the house.
Did they mention what a zip head is?
yeah. Well, that sort of stuff where it's like, oh, they were so tired of the beat and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, you are overestimating how much I care about these particular characters, but that's what novelizations are all about, where it's like, well, we can fill in the blanks because the movie's already out and people are only going to read it if they're super into the movie and want to know these things are happening in the margins.
That guy had a page count.
Yeah. Before this post, I'll read up and see if those are actually, if they were paying for their food by riding the bikes to keep the place powered up.
I love hearing about future drugs in any kind of speculative fiction. And like the way they talk about her, like she seems pretty tranked up. And then like Marty Jr., when that car almost hits, I'm like, what are you, a trank head? Or like nobody's drunk in 2015. They just, are constantly tranquilized in some way.
I think we're going to actually get to the games in our last podcast in the series, just because we're only in Act 1 of this movie, just to let you guys know. Yeah. So we'll talk about those in the next podcast, I believe. But the first act is just so much fun. So much stuff is happening. So many things to look at, especially like in the background of like the McFly house, the rundown, future rundown McFly house. I love the pizza looks so good. I love just like... I mean, because Marty McFly gets fired by a Japanese boss, there's just like, well, yes, Japan has taken us over, but also at dinner, they're drinking like green tea and stuff. So like the Japanese influence is very much like lightly sprinkled throughout their household and throughout this world.
And Griff has a futuristic, diverse cyberpunk gang of like, you know, you got one white guy, you got a girl and a Japanese guy. Because at least I'm guessing he is of some Japanese ethnicity, because he has a rising sun hoverboard.
Yeah.
So, and that's a man whose word, the way he says power, it has stayed in my head since I saw it 30 years ago.
And of course, hoverboard's not real, but Zemeckis put out the lie that they were.
Yeah.
And it made the screenwriter very mad, because he still gets asked about that all the time. Just like, no. But I found out in a very boring way, you can make a hoverboard, but it must run along a magnetic track. So it's very, very boring.
Yeah, that's lame. And maybe, so in the future, maybe there's just magnets under everything except for water.
Yeah, just like magnet railways going under everything.
Yeah. I do wonder if he had just copped to it when the movie came out and said, no, those were fake. If we wouldn't have the last, 35 years of people trying to make close enough replications of the hoverboard. Because I feel like a lot of people just have tried to make hoverboard technology because they were so taken in by the lie in 1989.
I think so, yeah.
In a way, Zemeckis controlled science by controlling the dreams of the dreamers in that way. What all the great stuff they could have invented if those dorks hadn't been focused on trying to make a fake hoverboard. We could be living in a true flying car, Shangri-La.
I could be on Mars right now.
I also love that the flying cars, you see the flying cars like, oh, how cool. And then a little bit in there, Doc goes like, ah, traffic's terrible. It's like, even when everything can fly, there's still traffic jams.
As President Scroop said, even in the future, nothing works from Spaceballs.
And also like how he says, well, yeah, they can have the weather timed to the minute, but the post office still sucks. It's
One final thing in this act is like something I got slightly wrong in the first podcast, where there's a deleted scene, and there's not many deleted scenes in this movie, but when Biff returns the DeLorean to 2015, old Biff, after he gives himself the almanac, he seemingly dies in the finished movie, but in the deleted scene, he fades away. And that's because in their headcanon, Zemeckis and Gale, they're like, well, Lorraine murdered Biff in the 90s. And because it's 2015, he no longer exists. So that's the reason why. But in order to understand that, you have to have seen the entire movie. So test audiences were confused, like, why is this old Biff fading away?
Why did we watch the old man die after he just came back?
Yeah.
Oh, I assumed he died just because he had erased that version of himself from history by changing the past.
That does
But I guess that's not how it works, is it? No, it does. That is how it works. Yeah. So
that does make more sense, Jeremy, and that was my theory. But according to the screenwriter and Zemeckis, it's like, well, Lorraine shot Biff in the 90s.
Yeah,
so
way darker.
Well,
I mean, that deleted scene is sort of hinted at, because when Biff returns, he's all like, he's in a bad way when he returns. And watching the deleted scene, like, it's sort of a heart attack. Like, you don't know exactly what's happening. He does disappear, but it's like, well, is he, like, short of breath and seemingly, like, the way that he dies is weird, because he should just disappear and it, like, his death throes shouldn't be a part of it. But it was very confusing, even just seeing that scene when he gets back and he's all, like, befuddled and in a bad way.
I guess what we saw when Marty played Earth Angel, that it has a physical effect, you're disappearing. Like, it's you don't just disappear while you feel fine. You also are like almost passing out.
You have time poisoning.
And Marty is a healthy young teen, and meanwhile Biff is like an 85-year-old who's had a lot of 78,
I think.
Okay.
Actually, you're right, because when he's playing that song and he's starting to, like, he's not just disappearing. He's disappearing, but also kind of dying. It's a weird thing that they never really explain that. Like, why is a side effect of disappearing also, like, becoming physically ill?
Yeah, Biff doesn't get, like, the fading photo or anything. He just automatically disappears.
Oh, and also, in the future, one other thing they got right, Japanese bosses still like fax machines.
Several of them, yeah.
I love another great moment of a very like pitiful Willy Loman kind of thing where he's just like, it's a joke, Mom, it's a joke. Like, she's like, what does this mean? Like,
and then sitting down with his broken hand trying to play Power of Love.
Oh, what a sad man. And I also a great cover for that family eating together scene is, you know, they're so showing off of like, look, Marty, like Michael J. Fox is pouring a drink for Michael J. Fox and he drinks it. But it by having the two other Michael J. Foxes wear eye concealing glasses, they avoid any eye line problems. Like it, you don't get that uncanny valley that in Roger Rabbit they could just fix out of like, well, yeah, Eddie Valiant's looking here, but Roger shouldn't be here. Oh, let's draw Roger on his tiptoes. Like, that's a famous story of how they fixed it.
I never thought of that. Okay,
yeah,
perfect.
It's that's how I deconstructed it, is but the technology of it. Yeah,
in the deleted scenes there's like a master shot of all of them doing different things at the table together. It's like such a show-offy thing, but ultimately it means nothing. And they cut it out, and the special effects guys were so mad because it's three Michael J. Foxes each coexisting and moving around, and it didn't really do anything for the movie.
Yeah, another bit of a novelization that's that kind of expounds a little bit of these scenes that has stuck with me for the last 30 years or 25 years or whatever since I've read that book is that Lorraine is a little bit ashamed that they have a crappier model rehydrator. That it takes 15 seconds to rehydrate their pizza. She is disappointed that they don't have a rehydrator that works faster.
Wow, that's hilarious.
I definitely have
It also it shows that they're not quite, you know, high class McFlys.
And but it also predicted like smart homes. Like, I want to open my door and like, welcome, Lord of the Manor, King of the Castle.
And you can do voice command lights in your house now. If you want to have Jeff Bezos listen to you at all times, you can do.
Well, he knows what I want to buy.
I want that. Also, I love another great set design thing is just that Statue of Liberty torch lamp that Marty walks by. Old Marty walks by. I love that. Yeah. And then this could have been so much more for Elizabeth Shue. She does good with just the, you know, hiding around the house type thing. But then they knock her out again.
That's a great like pratfall, though. The I'm young, I'm old kind of thing with both versions of her.
And one of the funniest lines in the movie is Doc's speech about like how the entire universe could end, and he's like, well, you know, that's just a worst case scenario, maybe just this galaxy just go away.
It's a mouthful for him. We have to move on though to 1985A, the middle act of the movie, where the characters don't really, it's more about learning about what happened and taking in the horror of this new world. Now I have to say, this podcast is launching at an inopportune time for the Patreon folks. It's a day before Election Day. For the non-Patreon folks, it's a week 6 days after Election Day. So I apologize if the wound is still fresh, but Biff Tannen in this movie completely modeled after Donald Trump. This dark reality version of him, he was a prominent public figure in 1989, if you weren't alive or old enough at the time to be aware. And when I saw this again for the most recent time in 2016, he was running for president. And I was like, well, yeah, even as a 7-year-old, I was like, I've seen Donald Trump in Mad Magazine. I know what parody is. It's supposed to be him. And then watching in 2016, I didn't know a lot about Trump outside of, you know, what you learned about him running for president. I was like, well, yeah, he's a braggart. He's got the goofy hair. He's the real estate guy. But upon watching it this time, did I realize, like, oh my God, it is so much more than just the superficial qualities. Like, this is a savage parody of Donald Trump when he was only in his 40s.
Oh, man, it's painful to watch now just how correct it was.
Like,
but yeah.
Even down to his, like, racist landlord policies.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
When Marty returns to 1985, there's a black family living in his house. He gets chased out, and the father's like, we're not going to sell to you. We're not selling. We're not leaving. And you see the entire neighborhood is, like, all blacked out, and there's, like, a Biff Realty sign in every lawn.
Yeah, he's trying to get out the black families, and, like, Ed... I'm also really glad they had that line at the end there, because at first it's teased like that this is a mix-up, that the father just thinks that Marty McFly is a person who broke into his daughter's room for nefarious purposes. And I was, you know, you could be fearful that you're going to have to see jokes about that, or not jokes, but like that situation, to then make it about like, oh, you're just trying to scare us off our property. I was like, oh, thank God we're talking about racist real estate scandals instead of sexual assault here.
Also, that everything has to be explained to Marty. The fact that, like, I think he points out when they put when they do as they do with Elizabeth Shue in this movie and make her lie down somewhere, he notices, oh, there are bars on the window, which at that point he should realize, like, well, if that's how that house is and my house I can't get into, perhaps I don't live in my house anymore. But he doesn't realize that until he literally lands on somebody inside the house.
I want to know how this struck us all upon seeing this recently, because again, we have lived through 4 years of Donald Trump, and it is so surreal to see like the villain of this 80s movie has been our president for 4 years.
Yeah, I think it really hit me when Doc Brown said, well, you know, this it may as well be hell, basically. I'm like, yeah, I'm feeling that.
I'm starting to feel like we are living in 1985,
God, no, yeah.
Yeah, the people driving around in the big trucks shooting guns is very 2020. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Trump loves his big, beautiful bikers and all the boaters, too.
If only there were boats here, but I guess Hill Valley's landlocked, so we're not going to see any boaters. But
yeah, especially in the last year, Kid, I Own the Police is a that's a darker line too.
That too, that stuck out to me too, which is like you never see cops in these movies to begin with, which is a problem. But then you realize like, oh yeah, Marty can't go to the cops. And like, man, Tom Wilson as this character should just be another buffoon. He is a murderer. He is like such an intimidating villain in this form, despite being a buffoon with ridiculous hair and like a fat suit and everything. Like he is like such a fearsome villain.
In the third act, you know, there's moments where you see him decide, like, I'm not just going to be a bully. I will try to murder this person. And it shows that it just takes a tiny little push to get him, just the promise of being rich, gets Teen Biff to go from regular bully to killer. And this Biff has been rich for decades, so he's done everything he wants to do over and over again. Like,
I just got to say one thing. God bless America.
God, I love that line is perfect. Yeah. I love, too, that he got so smart that in the a very helpful video that explains how Biff got rich.
Which I think there's an extended version of that on the ride.
Oh, yeah.
When you ride the ride. Well, when you used to be able to ride the ride.
Yes. Yeah. In the Biff video, that he even waited to his 21st birthday, because it's like, well, if he makes $1 million in one day illegally when he's not of age, then that screws up his whole plan. So he has to do it on his 21st birthday.
That's true. It was a good touch.
Yeah. And also in those, you know, you pause the headline. Lines on the newspaper, you see like he bought a toxic waste place, they are approving to put toxic waste all over. This is why Hill Valley looks so bad, because he's literally poisoned the ground around it, not just filled it with illegal gambling and controlling the cops, but like he has salted the earth, basically.
Yeah, and blotted out the skies as well. In a deleted scene you do see the burned down school. It's a really cool shot.
Oh, that's great. Oh God, seeing the principal with his shotgun and like bandolier there.
That's great. Jeremy, any thoughts on the Biff Trump connection? I mean, it was explicit. Like, even so, Lorraine is like a different kind of functional alcoholic in this 1985, in which appearance wise she is based on Tammy Faye Baker, the wife of the famous scam lord preacher, who eventually recanted and became a good person. But it's perfect that it's like Trump.
Tammy Faye did not her husband, not Jim Baker.
But like, it's perfect that we have a Trump caricature and a Tammy Faye caricature as like the tackiest 80s power couple together.
I mean, I don't really have much to add. I think we've kind of covered it pretty thoroughly, but you know, I do think this was by far the most on point and merciless rendition of Trump in media at the time. And he was very ripe for satire. I mean, you know, even the Bloom County comic put his brain inside a dead vomiting cat.
That's true.
And
yes.
Turned him into the president. But
Bill,
you know, that was ridiculous. Whereas this is like, oh, yep, here's the future. Like they actually saw 2016, not 15.
Yeah. I do like how they show that 1985 Biff has diversified his interests, because something that always stuck into my head when I watched this was like, at some point, him betting on all of these sports events will change sports. Like, when he's making millions, is that changing how the teams play? And does the book change along with it? Or does the book become useless at some point? That always, I didn't quite understand how, you know, becoming a billionaire on sports betting at some point has to, maybe do they change legislation on how you, I think actually they do point out that he just changed legislation.
He legalized
like, allow,
it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And this is the most like It's a Wonderful Life part of the movie. Like, he comes back to Pottersville, and this is totally like inspired by the Capra movie.
Yeah, the way Marty's walking around confused by it is the same. He should, if he only grabbed someone by the lapels and say like, "Why, you talk straight to me?"
This some kind of game?
I think it's one of the things you threw out there, Dave, is that we've seen that a newspaper or a matchbook or a photo, if you bring a thing from the future to the past with you, information changes on it as the future changes.
That's
so
true.
I definitely think his almanac, like if he bet on the World Series and kept winning it, wouldn't the teams even notice, like, oh, he bet on us. Okay, then let's change how we play.
He would have been killed by the mafia.
Yes, that I guess it's because he got rich in a small place like Hill Valley. There was no mafia to kill
him.
Yeah,
and he never left.
Yeah.
And I will say, like, I love the scene in this second act where, you know, Marty discovers his father is dead. And then that's when Doc appears. He's like, I'm going to tell you how big you fucked up.
Yeah.
And then he's like, he's breaking it down. And I love, like, and this has happened to me. It's like, you fucked over your best friend too, buddy, with this gambling trick. And I love it. It's in any other movie, it would be so hokey and too expository. But I love the blackboard scene.
Yeah.
And like, now we've internalized all this time travel mechanics, but it was so necessary for this 89 audience, but it works. It works so well.
I really think it was essential for them to lay out the idea of time paradoxes and split timelines in a very simple, visible fashion like this, because it was something you didn't really see a lot in media at that point. So, I think it works really well.
A teacher with a chalkboard pointing at lines like, no, see, he underlines 1985A. No, that doesn't work. Like it. And this taught people, I said this in our last one about these, but this taught people, as film viewers, the rules of time travel that they have to explicitly say in Avengers Endgame, Back to the Future doesn't count here. That's not right. Like, they have to, which, by the way, if you enjoy the Avengers films and Back to the Future, the Russo brothers and the two writers of Infinity War and Endgame, they did an hour-long interview with Bob Gale about Back to the Future, and they are like fawning fans who are like, we made movies because of you. Thank you, Bob Gale. And Bob Gale's like, oh, you kids. Aw.
Yeah. I think this movie in particular and then the third one both kind of, you know, saw into the future of like IMDb and people nitpicking movies, because it's so many times in this movie and in the third one they say like, oh, well, why don't we just do this? And then Doc literally explains we can't do that because, or we can't go back to 2015 because 2015 changed. And by the end of the movie, we can't land on Biff because our car would get crushed, not his. Then in the third, all explaining all the ways that you can't get a 1885 DeLorean up to 88 miles per hour. I just thought it was, you know, like we're nitpicking it, but even then, like they nitpick their own movie. And that's why the whole series holds up so well, is because they thought, you know, over like these things multiple times and explain why you can't do certain things.
Well, yeah, Doc Brown is there to make the movie pedant proof as much as possible.
Because Zemeckis and Gale, they grew up the nerds of sci-fi B-horror movies and comic books, and they were the pedants themselves who would be mad if Dr. Frankenstein went somewhere he couldn't have or whatever. Like, that's not the rules for Dracula. They knew those things, and so now they could finally fix them and have a character like Doc be the official scientist of the movie. Like, oh my God, when he explains like, well, you have to go back to November 12th, 1955. Maybe it's the nexus of all things that ever happened. Or is this a giant coincidence?
Yeah, and like all time travel games rely on this mechanic where just like it's one event that everything hinges on. You need to fix that event and then the timeline will be fixed.
Yeah, which somehow Biff seeing a flying car and all of these other things, that doesn't change the future. That's all the same, just if you get rid of that almanac, which I guess you just have to say, like, well, Biff was pretty brain damaged all that night, and that explains it. But and then the way they layer in just a little bit of stuff for part three, not only with like the doc saying like once I'm basically saying if he doesn't obsess about time travel anymore, he could finally get a girlfriend.
Yeah,
he's never...
and the shot of Clint Eastwood, and then the flickering of the 1885 on the DeLorean's time readout. He's like, yeah. I gotta get the fix someday, Marty.
Yeah, and you see they mention Tannen's 1885. Yeah,
Buford.
Guy too. God, yeah.
One final thing in Act Two before we speed through Act Three is that like I did notice that the rest of them, like the McFly family doesn't matter anymore, but we do get mentions of Linda, Dave McFly, and Jailbird Joey, who we never see except as an infant in the first movie. But there was the deleted scene with Dave McFly in which he is a wino that Marty stumbles into on the steps of Biff's pleasure mansion.
Damn.
And that scene only exists for Marty to know that his mother is up there.
Ah, okay.
But they didn't need that information. So Dave, they cut out a vital Dave from this movie. And I hope you're okay with that.
And I was angry, believe me.
Dave McFly.
But I think actually another reason they didn't include that scene is because the actress who played Linda, I believe, was pregnant at the time or was unable to appear in the movie. So, or actually they may have filmed her because she was pregnant, and that was her affliction, is that she was pregnant.
Wendy Jo Sperber.
Because they couldn't have the parallel of showing what happened to the sister, they didn't want to show what happened to the brother. So they just kind of alluded to it during that conversation between Biff and Lorraine.
I like that they're not completely forgotten. Dave, he was a Model Burger King employee. We all remember him from that.
The end of Act Two of Marty confronting Biff with that information. Like, I like too that Marty underestimates Biff when he's like, oh, if I confront him, Biff will just tell me everything. And then Biff then reveals to him like, yeah, but I was also told if an old man or a young kid ask about this, I should murder them right now, and I'm gonna.
A crazy-eyed old man.
Yeah.
Wild hair.
Never thought it'd be you.
So Act 3, we'll go over this in like 10-15 minutes, but so when I was a kid and watching this movie and not having an appreciation for the full story, Act 1 was the highlight, right? It was like, oh, the cool future stuff. Now for me, this is the highlight, is going back to the first movie and interacting with scenes from the first movie and also trying to not fuck up what Marty does in the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's so cool, and it's also what I like about it is that it is a love letter to itself. Marty McFly is a fan of his own movie. There's a scene in this movie where he's like, oh God, I gotta watch the scene of George knocking out Biff. It's great. So like, mm-hmm. even Marty likes the movie just like you. I love that. It's so self-indulgent, but it's cute.
Yeah, and I think it's a benefit of this being filmed multiple years later that people had watched that first movie so much, they knew all of these scenes so well, and the producers and the writers and everyone who worked on this movie knew that people had analyzed every scene, that they don't try to do anything. They don't try to cheat. It's all everything that happens here. It happens in the background and not in a way that it would ever interrupt what's happening in that movie. Like, the one thing I think of is the principal. Like, had he been in one scene he's not in so many of the scenes by the time the dance comes around that you can have that little side thing where he steals the magazine and Marty has to go follow him because he was not in those scenes. So that works completely perfectly. And being able to have all these things happen in the background, it is a love letter to the first movie, and it never betrays any of the continuity of it.
And they have such great excuses about how they royally fuck up being in November 12th because Marty gets stuck in a garage for like 4 hours.
Yeah.
Can't do anything else. And he leaves it to Doc, and Doc's like, oh, I can do it. And it takes him hours to buy a bicycle and a costume.
And find Biff's house. Yeah. He's like looking at a map when he's like shakily riding his bike.
It's because he's like, well, I can't just drive around in a DeLorean or fly in the daytime. I'm sorry.
Yeah. They work very hard to be like, no, this resolution has to happen during the dance.
Mm-hmm.
It has to happen then.
Yeah.
Yeah, though the part of me that always thought like they have multiple attempts, I would, if I was Doc, I would have just called Mulligan at that point. Like, okay, you're in the garage. Look, that's really going to screw things over. Let's just do this again, and then maybe leave a note for yourself in the garage to like, yeah. Hey, just head home. There's another two versions of us that got this instead.
It helps that they are separated as well, because if Marty wasn't stuck in the car that drives away with Biff, if they could have talked to each other and just stood like, okay, what do we do now? Then they might have come up with that. But Marty's stuck in the car with Biff, so he can't really leave anywhere. And he can't even talk to him on the walkie-talkie because he goes through a bridge or through the tunnel.
This entire like act is like a stealth mission for Marty. Yeah. And I love watching the first movie thinking, well, of course Marty is up in those rafters, and of course Marty's sneaking around the school. Oh, he's in the principal's office now. Like, you could watch the first movie thinking like, well, Back to the Future 2, Marty is here. Mm-hmm. He's just off screen. He's doing stuff.
When I remember, Lorraine says to Biff when he shows up in one, like, you're drunk. You see, when Biff arrives and meets with Billy Zane and the other two guys, they give him alcohol. They are spiking the punch, and he is getting drunk. You're seeing it happen.
And we also see like additional scenes of him dealing with the repairs of his car, which makes him even more murderous towards Calvin Klein.
He always said to Calvin Klein in the first movie, he says to him, like, this cost me $300. And you then get to see earlier when he's like, $300? And he's arguing with Roger Rabbit again about that.
Charles Fleischer just wanted to play a human being. Jeremy, I really want to know, like, I didn't get a full appreciation for this until like my 20s when I watched all the movies back to back, and like, to me still, like, this could be like one of the coolest ideas ever in a movie, to just go back to the first movie, not just for the cynical nature of showing you what you already love, but just for like the sheer fuckery of it all. Like, what was it like to be there witnessing this happen?
Like someone said, you know, I had seen this movie quite a few times by the time this came out. So there was this appreciation for like the fact that, hey, it's that thing that we recognize, but it's all so seamless, and they do a really good job of linking scenes together. Like, you know, Skinner in his office looking through the book that he swipes from Biff, and then kind of catching, you know, like something catches his attention and he heads out of the office and then has to go, you know, deal with stuff. Like, there's a lot of things that really clearly tie like continuity together for events of the first movie. And it's really effective and really thoughtful. So I think it works that way, even though it's kind of conspicuous, you know, like Marty's creeping along up in the rafters of, or whatever it's called, the gantry, the rigging of the stage. Like, you know, you're not seeing him in the original sequence, but I don't know, it all does work. And it was very cool and impressive. And I don't think we'd really seen anything like that in a movie before. It was definitely great use of special effects and split screen, but also just really thoughtful staging and scene construction, so that all of this worked. And, you know, it didn't undermine the first movie. You can say, you know, all the stuff that I saw, it still happened. It still worked.
I think
that's really impressive.
I think the one major change that happens visibly to the timeline is that Marvin Berry has to take a step around a ladder to call his cousin Chuck. That's right. Like the one major change.
I even appreciate the fake out where Marty thinks he's gotten the almanac and it's actually not.
Ooh la la.
Ooh la la. Ooh la la. Yeah, it's a great fake out because you think, oh, he did it. But no, Biff is super sleazy. So of course he still has the almanac himself, and he got his porn magazine taken.
And they set up that dust jacket in the first act. The lady explains what a dust jacket is.
That's so perfect. Yeah. God damn it.
I will say, like, because this is a middle movie, the resolution is not amazing. Like, I do like the action set piece that ends the movie. It was something that came in late. They realized they didn't really have a set piece, like a big set piece. So Biff and Marty's showdown, like hoverboard versus Ford in this tunnel. It's fun. It's cool. But like, the first movie's climax and the third movie's climax are very similar, but they're both very, very exciting and tense. This one is a little lacking, but I understand that because it is just the middle connective tissue between one and three. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't need
it. I feel like the climax of Act Two is more exciting with Biff, you know, trapping Marty out on the rooftop, and Marty just, you know, apparently leaping to his death, which is a gimmick that has been used time and again in media, like the, you know, the game Mega Man Legends starts with that in the prologue. Like people love doing that, like blind jump. Oh, my flying vehicle was here to save me.
And I noticed another thing. So like, I always notice something new with these movies when I watch it. One of the things I noticed was, it's what seems like a throwaway line when Marty comes back to the Biff Tower to confront Biff in the hot tub. The first thing he says, like, how did you get past security on the first floor? It's like, well, the DeLorean dropped them off at a higher level.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah. And so it's established somehow in our minds that the DeLorean is there waiting.
So Doc was backing him up the whole time.
Yeah, and, yeah. It wasn't just a blind, like, oh, Doc showed up out of nowhere.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and, like, the little thing of they need a rope for Marty to grab for the big exit from the action scene. But they don't, like, Doc doesn't just have a rope in his time machine, so he has to fuck up driving his flying car and grab onto a bunch of tassel, or I guess,
like, flags. A streamer or whatever?
Yeah, a streamer. Yeah. That's, yeah, it's...
For the housing development that they're going to live in.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that ends up saving him. And also that, like, another little bit I really like is how... that the joke that of Marty saying in the first movie, and you know, and if you ever have a kid when he's eight and he lights the carpet on fire, that thing, it works again because you think the scene is over if you forgot that joke, because you're seeing through the window Marty talking to Lorraine and George.
I love how it goes out of focus as not George turns his head towards the camera.
Yes,
it's perfect.
Yeah. But so you think that Marty's coming through the door then, but his speech about the carpet gives just enough time for the chicken thing to happen and then interrupt when he opens the door to actually leave.
It's so perfect. And again, think about that in the first movie when you're watching it, he just knocked himself out.
Yes, yeah. And the line he says, like, oh God, it feels like I was here just yesterday. And Doc's like, yeah, it was yesterday. You were here yesterday.
I just love, to wrap up really quick here, we're going to be ending this podcast soon, but I just love how much this movie still gives your brain to chew on. Just like when Marty is abandoned by Doc by accident at the end of the movie, when Doc disappears in the sky, suddenly the car pulls up and you think about, like, oh, like Doc knew exactly where Marty would be, so that letter has been aging in time waiting to be delivered to Marty seconds after he sees Doc leave. Like, stuff like that still makes my brain, like, catch on fire. And then, like, thinking about the second Doc sends Marty back to 85, another Marty runs up to him, and that's how the movie ends. Just thinking about, boy, what if that's how the first movie ended? You wouldn't need a second movie.
That the scene stopped for Doc Brown, but you didn't see it. Yeah, getting Count Floyd to play that guy is perfect, too.
Are you Marty McFly?
Because he arrives so menacingly. He's, you know, like a noir film heavy. He's like, well, then I got this for you.
Yeah.
I think he's coming to kill him, but Marty doesn't know what's going on. And then his description of, like, yeah, we've had this for, you know, 70 years, and now, well, I got a bet going if a person will actually be here in 70 years. And it's also, it's an ad for Western Union that you can, but that's great too, because Western Union would exist in 1885, so it is a business he could give it to.
The only weird thing, at the end of the movie, suddenly Marty starts calling him the Doc, and I'm like, is this a script problem or a script error? It's like, the Doc's alive! It's just like, the Doc?
He's in the past, but he's alive! Ah,
you okay, son?
And also that he needs that information, because if you're a viewer of the movie, you're also like, well, how's Marty's trapped in 1955 now? What's going to happen?
I do love that Joe Flaherty and Tom Wilson in the 80s, they were playing on 1950s nostalgia. And then in the 2000s, they would both be on Freaks and Geeks, which played off of 80s nostalgia 20 years later.
Wow, you are so right. I guess there was one big plot hole, the one CinemaSin, I joke, fuck Bing. CinemaSins anyway. But the one CinemaSin I will complain about here is how when Marty's in they were going back to 55 and they're talking about changing 85 back to how it was, he's like, but what about Ayn and what about Ayn and Jennifer? No, everything will change around them and they'll be fine. Like, really?
The poor girl's doomed. I guess some final thoughts here before we wrap up. Again, there are three games to talk about for part two and one game to talk about for part three, and we'll do that in the third movie podcast, because that movie is great. I think it's underappreciated, but there's less mechanically to talk about, so that discussion won't be shorter than this one. But I will say my final thoughts are, like, the first movie is still still the best movie, like with the perfect scripts and so much love and heart. This movie doesn't have those qualities to that extent, but I still think it moves so fast and has so many ideas that it is just as entertaining. Maybe not as satisfying, but still like a perfect setup for the finale. Final thoughts, Dave, as the resident biggest Back to the Future fan, future owner of the 40th anniversary edition and the 45th anniversary edition and so on. Let us know, what do you think about this movie after watching it again?
Well, I remember as a kid, I this was my favorite just because they did so much time traveling. And then I remember for a while, I would, you know, I still do prefer the original Back to the Future. But this is such a close second. And, you know, 3 is not terrible, but it, like, these two are just, they exist on such a high level. Yeah, and something I wanted to quickly touch on was that, like, yeah, this is a confined world. It's just Hill Valley. But they do kind of show you that the stakes kind of extend outwards. And as a time travel geek, I loved seeing, you know, the first movie, it was just that picture. This one, that they have that whole newspaper, and it's a fun thing to pause and see all the other things, like Nixon's fourth term and yeah, all this other stuff. And it pays such good homage to the first movie and the concept of time travel. 3 kind of moves away from that, but it's fun in its own way. But I really love that it treats the first movie so well, and it doesn't betray any of the ideals. And it's a movie that knows that it was filmed years later, so it has to do its homework, and it totally did. And there's a reason that the Back to the Future method of time travel is the one that sticks into people's heads so much and has to be explained in Avengers, because they did their homework, and this movie is the one that did the homework. Like, obviously there was a lot of rules made in the first one, but this one, they really established the rules. And basically time travel movies have had to, you know, either exist within the same framework or do a lot more homework to explain their own version of it just because of this movie, which is astonishing.
Jeremy, what are your thoughts on this one?
I've really warmed up to this one over the years. You know, we were, like I said, excited about the possibility of a very immediate sequel to this one. But, you know, there was this kind of lingering, I guess, uncertainty about what this movie was. I mean, I think at this point we were kind of expecting sequels, second movies in a series, to be darker, to be more complex, to be more challenging, to be more downbeat, you know. But the question was, is this a more complex movie in the sense of Empire Strikes Back, where it's good, or is it a darker movie in the sense of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where it's actually bad? Mm-hmm. And so I think we needed to see, you know, the third movie and then get some distance to finally be able to say, like, oh yeah, this is interesting, and this really does a lot of heavy lifting, a lot of work to lay down a finale for the franchise, for the series, and really wrap up the story. But this is where everything escalates and becomes more complex to give the third movie something to resolve for us. So yeah, I think it's a very successful movie. And even though, of course, the future stuff is very silly and not at all like the future that we recognize in most senses, there are some parts that are, you know, in the dystopian era that resonate a little too much. So it kind of balances out.
It's true. Henry, how about you? Final thoughts on this one?
I appreciate this even more each time I watch it. Like, I'm still repeating what I felt in the first podcast too, that I do think the first movie is like the best one, but the complexity of this one and how it plays with all the toys and the bigger budget and all of these options they have available. And also when they know they have a third movie, the extra stuff they can layer in to pay off, you know, in Back to the Future 1, they could have a thing they say that's just seemingly a nothing line in Act 1 and pay that off in Act 3. But now they can do it 6 months apart in a whole film apart. They can just keep paying those things off. The wild gunman scene has no reason to exist in here other than just like to have kids say current video games are boring to them in the future. But it pays off of like, that's why Marty can even shoot a gun and be accurate. Like, so little things like that, I just appreciate so much. And when you know the effort that went into everything they design in it, like by giving you a future to imagine and thinking it through as well as they did. Like, and it also, the last thing it gave me more appreciation for watching it now was I had thought that the Institute of Future Technology that was at Universal Studios, the building for the show, I thought it looked kind of lame. And I was like, well, it's just like a warehouse with like points in it. But that exact style of building is right next to the clock tower in 2015.
Oh, okay.
Like that type of architecture actually fits for the future. Now it doesn't fit as a show building for Krusty the Clown's Krusty Land, but that's a whole other story. So it even gave me more appreciation for one of the few flaws I saw in the Back to the Future ride, which is one of my favorite rides ever.
So thanks again for joining us for another episode of Retrons. A fun topic as we straddle a historically interesting election, let's say. And yes, so thanks for joining us. If you, we are located on Twitter as Retronauts. If you want to support the show and get some cool bonuses, please go to patreon.com/retronauts. Sign up there for $3 a month to get access to all these podcasts 1 week at a time, ad-free, at a higher bitrate. And then if you sign up for $5 a month, you'll get 2 bonus podcasts every month. Those are full-length podcasts. We've been doing this for all of 2020 so far. We'll be doing it in the future as well. So if you have not been part of that tier, we have probably done over, I will say, 20 podcasts at this point that you haven't heard. They're all full-length, and that includes the original Back to the Future podcast. And again, that is located at patreon.com/retronauts. And also at that tier, we have a weekly column by Diamond Fight and a mini podcast they put online every week as well. So that's another bonus you get on top of your bonus podcast as well at patreon.com/retronauts. That's what supports the show. And we couldn't do any of this without you. So thank you so much for considering supporting Retronauts. Jeremy, please let everyone know where to find you and what you're working on.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite and all over the place on the internet, you know, doing limited run games stuff. And also you can find me doing YouTube stuff on YouTube, talking about video games. I do a lot of that. Old video games. That's right. I'm on brand all the time. So that's where you can find me on the internet.
And Dave, how about you?
I'm at Dave Rudden on Twitter. And yeah, I would just love to chat more with people about this when this episode comes out. So, you know, just hit me up there. And try to needle me about reading that novelization, because I need to do my homework on that.
I want been a while since I've read it. Your full audiobook version. We'll pay you to make that an extra on Retronauts. you have to do all the voices for all the biffs, though, or else no money's in it. Henry, I think you podcast, right?
Oh, I've been known to, yes. So if you don't know yet, you really should. Me and Bob also host 2 weekly podcasts, Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. Me and Bob talk about a different animated series each week on What a Cartoon. And important for this one, you should hear me and Bob talk about the Back to the Future animated series with Dave Rudden on that very podcast. It's pretty recent at the time you're hearing this, so check that out on our What a Cartoon podcast feed. And of course, I'm sure you love The Simpsons, don't you? Don't you want to hear me and Bob talk about every episode of The Simpsons in chronological order? Well, you can on the Talking Simpsons podcast. And those are both supported on a Patreon to help me and Bob do it full time. That is at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. Sign up now, or else in the future you'll be saying, wish I could go back in time and put some money on that Patreon.
Put some money on the Mackies.
Yes. As for me, you can find me on Twitter as Bob Serbo. And thanks again for listening to another episode of Retronauts. We'll see you in the future. We'll be right back.